This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Tanya Beckett, and on The Inquiry, we're looking at how new vaccines might help in the treatment of cancer. It's estimated that around 20 million people worldwide will be diagnosed with some form of the disease in 2025. The Inquiry gets beyond the headlines to explore the trends, forces, and ideas shaping the world. Search for The Inquiry wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Warum nur an der Oberfläche kratzen? Bei einem Atemwegsinfekt ganz dünnes Eis.
Wenn Erkältungsviren auf die Bronchien schlagen, packt Umkaluabo den Infekt mit der Wurzel. Denn es lindert nicht nur die Symptome, sondern bekämpft auch die Erreger.
Umkaluabo.
Unaussprechlich, aber ausgesprochen gut.
Zu Risiken und Nebenwirkungen lesen Sie die Packungsbeilage und fragen Sie Ihre Ärztin, Ihren Arzt oder in Ihrer Apotheke.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, the Nigerian government has banned imported rice. Local farmers are struggling to keep up with demand, but these consumers want them to persevere.
Foreign rice is generally easier to prepare since it's already pre-processed, while local rice requires more effort and time. But despite the extra work, I personally prepare the taste of local rice. It has this unique gardi, a special test that foreign rice lacks.
Also, the Kenyan athlete Beatrice Chebet ran 5 kilometers in just over 13 minutes recently, smashing through her own world record. So we are asking, is there a limit to what the human body can achieve?
I must say that the records are going to continue falling. There is no limit to what a human being can do, because now there's a lot of science, a lot of data that is going into the preparation of athletes.
It's Tuesday, the 7th of January. First, we go to South Africa. Here's the scene. The lively sounds of a wine bar, clinking glasses, warm chatter and soft music in the background. We are in South Africa, in this case, because we are talking about the government's intention to increase the price of alcohol. Because seductive as the scene we've just witnessed is, the social, economic and health costs of alcohol abuse is very, very high. A World Health Organization report from 2018 reveals that 60% of drinkers above the age of 15 in South Africa drink very heavily. So will raising the price of alcohol help to reduce excessive consumption? There's a lively debate around the issue, so much so that the National Treasury has extended the public comment deadline to February the 14th. The first deadline was in the middle of last month. Not the best time to ask people who love to drink to think about not drinking. Or maybe it was the best time. Either way, Professor Corneille van Walbeek is from the University of Cape Town. As director of the research unit on the economics of excisable products, that's taxable products, he's been actively involved in the debate. So let's talk about the primary reason why the government is proposing an increase in alcohol prices. Is it to curb consumption, address public health concerns, or is it to increase revenue?
The main reason behind the government thinking the way that I interpret it is not to increase revenue, but primarily to reduce the social costs of drinking and to reduce drinking in total. If 60,000 or so people die every year from alcohol use, that's a huge public health concern. The cost to the economy have been estimated to be between 10 and 12% of the GDP. The revenue that the government get is substantial. Let's be honest, it's in the order of about 40 to 50 billion rand per year. That's in the order of about 4% of total government revenue comes in the form of excise taxes on alcohol. So it's a significant number in absolute terms, but as a percentage of the total, it's a modest percentage, but nevertheless still something that you think seriously about.
Yeah, not to be sneezed at, right? Because the South African economy has been struggling for several years and it needs whatever revenue it can get. So how will the government actually implement this price increase? Because it's not just increasing prices, right? It's actually at various different levels of alcohol percentage that the price increase will kick in.
Yeah, I think the critical thing is to realize that the government does not actually control the price of alcohol. What it does control is the excise tax. And of course, the excise tax then becomes a cost factor for the producers of alcohol. And that then becomes part of the cost structure and the pricing structure. And in that way, the excise tax then gets passed through to the consumers. So the way that the alcohol industry is then able to pass through that excise tax to the consumer, that is a critical component. Our research suggests that if the excise tax increases by 1 rand per liter of alcohol, that the price of alcohol actually increases by somewhat more than 1 rand. So there's a so-called overshifting of the excise tax.
So explain to us, what is excise tax actually?
Okay, so an excise tax is essentially a tax that is implemented or imposed on a very specific product that the government regards as socially undesirable for whatever reason.
So is this the sin tax, as it were, on tobacco products and on alcohol, right?
Exactly. So excise tax is just a technical term for what some people call sin taxes. The World Health Organization would prefer to call it health taxes, basically to encourage healthy behavior rather than atoning for your sins. So most people sort of think about excise taxes of this is a bad thing and I need to pay taxes in sort of a religious kind of way. But that's not the way that the World Health Organization wants to think about it. They want to sort of present it as it's a tax that is implemented in order to encourage healthy behavior. And healthy behavior means consuming less alcohol, consuming less tobacco, consuming less sugar-sweetened beverages.
So do you think that increasing excise taxes on alcohol in this particular case will control consumption? Will it stop people from drinking as much as they do?
Of course, it all depends what happens at the margin. So it's not a case that suddenly you increase the excise tax by 10, 20, 30% and all problems will be resolved. But what we do know, and the research is very clear on this, is that people respond to changes in the price. And a concept that we learn in economics, one, is the concept of the law of demand, which basically says that if the price goes up, consumption reduces. And over time, we've got multiple studies that have estimated what is the percentage change in the consumption as a result of a percentage change in the price. And for alcohol, generally speaking, the price elasticity of demand is in the order of minus 0.5. So for every 1% increase in the price, consumption of alcohol will decrease by 0.5%.
Can I sort of tease out something? When we say that consumption of alcohol decreases because people are sensitive to the price of it, don't we mean that the consumption of particular alcohols, that is the alcohol that is being taxed, decreases? It doesn't mean, though, that people stop drinking alcohol. Don't they just move to cheaper and more dangerous forms of alcohol?
Yeah, I think it's important to distinguish between, let's call it, people that are completely alcohol dependent and people that are not completely alcohol dependent. So people are not alcohol dependent, and there the law of demand applies very well. So if the product becomes more expensive, then they will cut down on their consumption of that product and spend their money potentially on other things. This could be other forms of cheap alcohol that is possible. But if all alcohol gets taxed in a similar kind of way, then all products become more expensive, and you find that on aggregate, there's going to be a reduction in alcohol consumption. For people that are completely alcohol dependent, there the law of demand would be much less effective because they are alcohol dependent. And even if the price goes to astronomical levels, you'd probably find that they're still going to try and find some way to find money. So let's exclude those alcohol dependent people for the time being and just focus on most people who are not alcohol dependent. And for them, the law of demand will come into play. And if the price of all alcohol were to increase, you're going to find that there might be some switching from more expensive alcohol to cheaper alcohol. But all the modeling suggests and indicates very clearly that if there is an increase in the price of all alcohol consumption will decrease.
Now, let's talk about some of the specifics of alcohol and alcohol addiction in South Africa, where you are, Cape Town, the Western Cape. Alcohol was used to pay people on the winelands of the Cape. Does that, do you think, contribute to vulnerability to alcohol, and how will curbing consumption and increasing the price help with that? I know you're an economist, but I'm just wondering whether that's one of the things that you might have considered as well in your studies.
Unfortunately, South Africa has a very, very high prevalence of fetal alcohol syndrome and fetal alcohol disorders. And A study that has been done quite recently suggests that up to 8% of South African children have got some form of FASD. In some provinces, specifically in the Northern Cape and to a lesser extent the Western Cape, fetal alcohol disorders are significantly high, up to 20% of the population having FASD. And that, of course, is a significant issue because this is something that is irreversible and basically puts those kids at a disadvantage for the rest of their lives. And the link between the prevalence of FASD and the DOP system, even though the DOP system has been abolished for decades, that still seems to linger. So the question is an increase in the price of alcohol going to reduce the prevalence of FASD? I'm not sure if one can necessarily say that. One can speculate. And my suspicion is that it might have a marginal impact on that simply because those people who would be the mothers of FASD type children, they are likely to be drinkers that are seriously addicted to alcohol and that it may not be as responsive to a change in the price of alcohol. They would typically consume cheap alcohol and home produced alcohol, which is going to be a significant problem and would not be affected by an increase in the excise on alcohol products.
Just remind us what FASD stands for.
Fetal alcohol spectrum disorders.
Fetal alcohol spectrum disorders.
Yeah. So in the past, we used to call it FAS, fetal alcohol syndrome, and now it's called fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, basically to account for the fact that it comes in various grades.
And the DOP system, tell us what's the definition of it.
So in the old days, when I'm talking about the old days, I'm talking about centuries ago, farmers would often pay their workers in the form of very cheap alcohol. Often that alcohol would have been produced on the farm itself. And the idea was to addict the workers in such a way that they would not leave the farm and basically be alcohol dependent and come to work on a daily basis because of the incentive of getting a mug or a dop of alcohol at the end of the day. It was a horrible, horrible system.
And it wasn't centuries ago. It was quite prevalent up until quite recently, wasn't it? Even though it was banned.
Yeah. So when I say centuries ago, it was probably started in the 18th century and it ran through the 19th and the early 20th century. As far as I recall, it was officially banned in the 1960s, but it was still done clandestinely up until at least the 1980s, possibly even the early 1990s.
Thank you very much for talking to us. This has been very interesting.
Audrey, thank you very much.
Corné van Baalbeek, Professor of Economics at the University of Cape Town. We've spoken about the drinks, now let's talk about food. Rice, to be specific. Local rice in Nigeria, to be even more specific. Because the government has taken steps to ban the import of foreign rice to encourage local production. Until 2015, Nigeria imported up to 4 million tons of rice a year, much of it smuggled in from neighboring Benin, and yet the country is the largest producer of rice in Africa. Domestic rice production has increased, but local farmers are still struggling to meet local demand. Imagine 200 million Nigerians needing rice. Local rice growers want to meet the demand because there clearly is demand for their product, as we've been hearing from these women.
I will say I've noticed that foreign rice is generally easier to prepare since it's already pre-processed and sometimes even partially cooked, as we call it here in Nigeria, parboiled. While local rice requires more effort and time, the process involves carefully picking out stones and thoroughly washing the rice before cooking. But despite the extra work, I personally prepare the taste of local rice. It has this unique gardi, a special taste that foreign rice lacks.
As a Nigerian woman, rice is a household delicacy. My experience cooking Nigerian rice mirrors cooking foreign rice because there are varied quality of locally processed rice, and when prepared well, they taste even better than their imported counterpart. I think Nigerian local rice is not just a meal, but also it is a heritage and a symbol of community.
So what more should the government do to encourage local production of rice? Alhaji Sadiq Umar Daware is a rice farmer and also a food security expert.
We are aware that the government has banned importation of rice into Nigeria, we believe with a very good intention to support local production. And that is the only way we can be able to diversify and increase the production capacity of smallholder farmers. However, this has to come with a lot of policies that can support the local production. Farmers today, a larger percentage of the rice farmers in Nigeria are smallholder farmers, those that cultivate 1 hectare, sometimes even less than a hectare. And their capacity to produce and get maximum yield is at its lowest ebb. So what we are expecting from the government is to support and increase the capacity of smallholder farmers so that we can be able to produce and compete favorably with other farmers across the continent.
So you're saying at the moment, smallholder farmers are not able to cope with increased demand, or they need to upscale in order to produce more product for people to consume?
Yes, it's no longer a news that the cost of agro input have jumped high. For example, the cost of certified seed has now doubled. The cost of agrochemicals that are used in clearing weeds and other insects has also increased tremendously. The cost of fertilizers has also gone very high. So you can imagine that a farmer that has to sell everything he has to fund just a small portion of his own farm. So by implication is that farmers in Nigeria today cannot be able to fund their production as they have been doing before, because the input has increased tremendously beyond their own imagination.
But has demand for locally produced rice increased since the government banned rice importation?
Honestly speaking, we never had it so good. People in Nigeria before thought foreign imported rice were okay. But with the ban on the importation of this rice, people have now restored to eating local rice, and we realize that it's more healthier, it's more nutrition, and Nigerians now restore to eating local rice happily.
Is the quality any different to imported rice?
Yes, there is a lot of difference in terms of quality. You are aware that in those rice that were imported, because of the quality of seed, because of the development of the irrigation facility, those rises are uniform and they are okay. But here, that because it is a scattered smallholder farmers, that you find out that most of those grains are not uniform. Some are long, some are short. And at the end of the day, during the process, you find out that the quality differs. But we believe that with the investment, people are bringing more latest machineries, even the quality of rice to some extent has started increasing now in Nigeria.
So what do you want government to do in order to boost production and to meet the demand?
Now, first of all, I have told you earlier that larger percentage of those farmers are smallholder farmers that doesn't have capacity to produce. So what we want is the Nigerian government should bring a policy whereby those smallholder farmers can be supported in terms of access to affordable finance. They also have access to market so that at the end of the day, they can get value for what they are producing.
And how close are you to getting and securing that support from government? Are they listening to you?
Yes, we had discussion with the Honorable Minister of Agriculture and Food Security. During electoral campaign, we had meeting with His Excellency the President on many occasions, and he made a lot of promises supporting Nigerian smallholder farmers. But we believe that the only way out is for him to support those smallholder farmers so that we can be self-sufficient in terms of food production in Nigeria.
Do you think that the government's restriction policies are sustainable in the long run?
The only way that program can be sustained and Nigerians will accept it happily is when they bring a policy that can support the local production. When there's a restriction and farmers has to go helter-skelter to look for expensive inputs, to also look for expensive loan from commercial banks, then the idea behind shutting down the Nigerian borders, I believe, will not augur well for Nigerian food security. While it is with a very good intention, then we also believe that government can do that. But we are anxiously waiting to see how government can be able to support local production. Our listeners may recall that the immediate past administration has to some extent supported Nigerian local farmers under the Ankoboros program, under the Presidential Fertilizer Initiative, and those to some extent has supported the production capacity of Nigerian farmers. And that is what brought about increase in the processing facilities. Before now, we only have six or less than even six processing facilities across Nigeria. But today, we have much more than that, up to 78 integrated rice mills spread across Nigeria. It's an indication that there is an increase in the local production. But that program has been shut down by the administration of His Excellency the President, and we are waiting to see maybe he can bring another program that can replace the Ankoboros program.
When you were talking earlier, I got the impression that money is really what is needed. For instance, you said that the costs of everything has doubled. Farmers are not getting the returns on what they have to put in. Is it just money or is there more to it?
No, it's much more to it. Farmers in Nigeria need a good training on best agronomic practices. Where smallholder farmers produce maybe 3 tons per hectare, in other countries of the world, they produce much more than that. Sometimes up to 8 metric tons. In some areas, we have 12 metric tons as output per hectare. So the training of Nigerian farmers is also needed, in addition to access to affordable finance.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That's Alhaji Sadiq Umar Daware, a rice farmer and also a food security expert. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
Hello, I'm Tanya Beckett, and on The Inquiry, we're looking at how new vaccines might help in the treatment of cancer. It's estimated that around 20 million people worldwide will be diagnosed with some form of the disease in 2025. The Inquiry gets beyond the headlines to explore the trends, forces, and ideas shaping the world. Search for The Inquiry wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Warum nur an der Oberfläche kratzen? Bei einem Atemwegsinfekt ganz dünnes Eis.
Wenn Erkältungsviren auf die Bronchien schlagen, packt Umkaluabo den Infekt mit der Wurzel. Denn es lindert nicht nur die Symptome, sondern bekämpft auch die Erreger.
Umkaluabo.
Unaussprechlich, aber ausgesprochen gut.
Zu Risiken und Nebenwirkungen lesen Sie die Packungsbeilage und fragen Sie Ihre Ärztin, Ihren Arzt oder in Ihrer Apotheke.
Minutes and 54 seconds. That's how long it took the Kenyan athlete Beatrice Chebet to run 5 kilometers in Barcelona recently. In the process, she smashed her own world record. Just days after that, the double Olympic champion won yet another race in Spain, stamping her authority on the 2025 athletic season. But how much faster can she and other elite athletes get? In 2019, Eliud Kipchoge became the first man to run a marathon in under 2 hours at the Ineos Challenge in Austria, and 16-year-old Gut Gut, the Australian sprinter of South Sudanese origin, ran the 200 meters faster than Usain Bolt had. These are astonishing feats of endurance, speed and power. But can the human body go even further, ever faster and stronger yet? Or is there a limit to what we can achieve with mere flesh and blood? The journalist and casual runner, Asha Komugisha, thinks we can go faster, higher, stronger. We kind of wondered whether there's a limit to what human beings can do, because it's not like we're going to be able to run a mile at under a minute or something like that. So what do you think, in the context of Beatrice Chebet's broken record, about the evolution of human performance in athletics?
Well, absolutely. You know, Beatrice right now is the most informed runner globally right now. And I mean, in the last 1 week, setting that world record on New Year's Eve, and then just on Sunday, winning another World Athletics Cross Country Tour gold meeting still in Spain. I mean, that speaks to the evolution, but also it's important for us to understand that a couple of things have changed over the years. Specifically, you can look at, for example, the professionalization of sports in general. Athletes now have have full-time training regimens. They have sponsors locked in, so they have nothing to worry about. Their flights are booked. They already know their schedule at the beginning of the year, and they know what they're going to do. For instance, just listening to Chebet on her return to Kenya, she said she's now going to lock in, go back to training, and her next race is on March 9th in Lisbon. So you see that there's a consistency here, but also you have to talk about technology and how everything has come together for the growth of athletics and running in general. And I'll take you back to October 2019 when we had the Ineos Challenge with Eliud Kipchoge, of course, the Kenyan great, considered the best marathoner in the world, coming together with Ineos and saying, you know what, let's see if a human being can run below 2 hours, can run a marathon. And you have a whole team of pacemakers, engineers, trainers, scientists and physicians coming together to say, okay, how can we make this happen?
I remember watching that. And right now, thinking back to it, I still get cold shivers. He wasn't competing against something else or somebody else. He was competing against himself with the best kind of technology, with the best encouragement and all of that. Just seeing the pacemakers as well and how they were urging him on to win. It was incredible to watch that race. But from an anatomical perspective, are human beings becoming faster and stronger, or is it just about how they are training, or are they being trained to become faster and stronger? And is there a limit to that?
It's a combination of both, okay? Because genetics is very important. It's kind of like how you will say that it's not surprising that the Springboks are the current rugby world champions, because rugby is literally ingrained in South Africans as a nation, all the way from primary school to secondary school. So it's the same thing, you know, when you look at, for example, the Rift Valley region in Africa. And when I say Rift Valley, yes, you're talking about Western Kenya, you're talking about all the way the stretch to Ethiopia, you're talking about Eastern Uganda. This particular region genetically is endowed, and that is one of the biggest factors that has helped these athletes. And of course, you talk about environmental conditions. When you look at Addis Ababa, Iten, Eldoret, Kapchora, Terriet, where these three nations where their athletes train, you're talking about 2,400 meters above sea level. That's outstanding for a human being to live at that altitude, get used to it, and then they're competing at about 100 meters above sea level. That's a huge difference when it comes down to the biometrics and looking at how the body can adapt to that. And yes, I must say that the records are going to continue falling. There's no limit to what a human being can do, because now there's a lot of science, a lot of data that is going into the preparation of athletes.
Are you sure that there's no limit? Because, I mean, we are made of flesh and blood, and there are physical restrictions. We can't move through time at the speed of sound. Surely not.
I mean, if somebody had told you in 1993 that you would sit on your bed and chat with people across the world in China or in Australia or in South America, you would not believe that.
Oh, I would have, because I read science fiction. Come on.
Surely not to what AI can do now. And I say that because you have to go back to when Otto discovered sliced bread and how that changed the industrial revolution, just slicing bread. So think about what technology can now do. So I think that we should not limit ourselves to what the human can do. And now you're seeing that in so many other things, in swimming, in football, and in many other sporting disciplines, that technology continues to push the human body. And we see that with, yes, world records, but also the style of play and the studies that are going into this. And I'll take you to, you know, a piece of academia actually written by a Kenyan associate professor of exercise and sports science, Dr. Vincent Ochengo Nywera, who explains with some of his colleagues about the favorable physiological characteristics that, for example, Kenyan athletes have, and how it's a particular tribe, especially the Kalenjins, whose percentage is above 70 in terms of winning marathons and long distances across the world.
Are women improving at a faster rate than men?
I think because the men were always involved at that level, So now the women are sort of playing catch up. Now you feel that, oh, there's actually more women embracing athletics and sports in general. But the answer in plain speak would be yes.
So what are you expecting this year? Beatrice Chebet shaved 12 seconds off her own record. That's a lot. Where do you see this going by the end of the year?
I think that, you know, more athletes are going to break their records, because when you look at Beatrice Chebet, she's just 24, especially also for a woman that says like still has like, what, another decade of running. And maybe perhaps at some point, maybe in a couple of years, maybe 5 or 6, she could actually say, you know what, I'm going to embrace the marathons. We've seen athletes who have gone all the way, especially female athletes who are even Kenyan, Tegla Lorup, Catherine Ndereba, who had to go all the way and continue to run at least later into their late 30s and embracing that high level competition. But I think that now that some big records have fallen, you know, like the marathon record, of course, Paula Radcliffe held that for a very long time. But Ruth shattering it just at the end of last year just shows you how these young athletes are. So now you have the fastest marathons in the world where, you know, these athletes, they're categorically saying, this is where I would like to try and break a world record. You have Berlin Marathon, the Chicago Marathon, Valencia, and of course London. And here, of course, the altitude is also coming into play. And it always also comes down to the depth and quality of the athlete lineup. When you have big superstars in the same race, it means that they're going to push themselves and try to break a world record, because of course they're trying to win the race. And in doing that, they end up winning the world record. So I believe that this year we're going to see a huge number of world records coming down. But also there's the World Athletics Championships in Tokyo. And of course, Tokyo having been undone by COVID-19 for the 2020 Olympics that happened a year later. Now the fans also will be in the stadiums packed, hopefully. And that also could be a huge factor for the athletes.
How much faster do you think athletes can get?
That's a good question. Depending on what stage they are in their lives, I believe that a couple of more seconds could fall off the current records that we have, especially in the long distance running. I believe that, you know, with the marathons, there could be more records falling, both for men and women, but also everywhere around 5 kilometers, 10 kilometers, the world cross country, as well as the 5,000 and 10,000 meters. I think that that's where the focus could be, but also maybe the 3,000 meters steeplechase. This could be an area of contention for both men and women. For the sprints, it's always kind of complicated because, you know, you have a shorter period to compete and bring your energy in there. But the longer races, I believe we could see more world records falling.
Okay. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much.
Asha Komugisha, one-time runner and sports journalist in Uganda. Focus on Africa was produced by Blessing Aderogba in Lagos, Susan Gashui and Frenny Jowi in Nairobi. Bella Hassan and Yasha Michelle were here in London, along with Paul Bachibinga, our senior producer, and Jack Graysmark, our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. In the next edition of our sister podcast, Africa Daily looks at one of Africa's oldest surviving political parties, the African National Congress, as it celebrates its birthday and asks, what's the future for South Africa's ruling party? I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.
Hello, I'm Tanya Beckett, and on The Inquiry, we're looking at how new vaccines might help in the treatment of cancer. It's estimated that around 20 million people worldwide will be diagnosed with some form of the disease in 2025. The Inquiry gets beyond the headlines to explore the trends, forces, and ideas shaping the world. Search for The Inquiry wherever you get your BBC podcasts.